Well, runners who like to visit other parts of the state and run in 5Ks or 10Ks or maybe even half marathons should be aware that there's a, I guess, kind of a once-in-a-lifetime event happening in Detroit. It's a 5K to celebrate, well, really to say goodbye to the Joe Louis Arena. In true Hockey Town fashion here, the Red Wings are hosting the Hockey Town 5K coming up in September, September the 10th, beginning at about 8 a.m. This, of course, ahead of the new arena that the Red Wings will call home. But there will be Red Wings stars from the past will be there, and a chance to say goodbye to the Joe Louis Arena for Red Wings fans here coming up September the 10th. It's Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for joining us today. Three volunteer counselors have been dismissed by the Listening Ear Crisis Intervention Center in East Lansing after it was discovered that they were on Michigan's sex offender registry. Justin Hinckley of the Lansing State Journal first reported the story. Along with firing the three people, the Listening Ear will begin performing background checks on all counselors. As a result of the incident, State Senator Curtis Hertel Jr. has begun drafting legislation to prevent registered sex offenders from counseling sexual assault victims or children. Yesterday, I asked Hertel to describe what Michigan law has been lacking.
Yeah, it's one of those situations that I assumed what was happening was against the law. And I think most people would feel that way as well, that it seems like common sense that a sex offender is not allowed to work with those that have been sexually abused or children. Unfortunately, that was not the case. And when I and my staff figured it out that it wasn't the case, we immediately sprung into action, and we used one of our two legislative priorities that we get during the session to that speed up the process to have a bill drafted. I hope that bill will be on the floor this week. I hope we'll be able to get as many co-sponsors as possible. I assume it'll have strong bipartisan support, considering what we're talking about.
And how would your legislation address the problem exactly?
What my legislation will do is to make it a crime for a sex offender to volunteer in an organization that deals directly with sexual abuse victims and or children, and put the onus really on them that they have a responsibility to avoid certain areas. And we already have rules like that in place in the state. And I think that is the best way to assure that a situation like what happened in the Listening Ear will not happen again.
What role do background checks play?
I think background checks are important. I am sort of surprised they weren't being done there. I think they should be done at all nonprofits. At the same time, the state has a certain role to play, and I'm not sure if our role is to tell every organization how to run. I think in this situation, we're best actually focusing on the offenders and making it a criminal act if they actually violate it. If they violate the terms of their parole, if they violate the law, they will be punished. And I think that is a more effective way in this regard than getting to all these different organizations.
I know you're hoping for bipartisan support. Are you expecting it?
I think so.
Are you hearing of it?
Yeah. From the discussions I've had, you know, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, nobody is, I think, opposed to this idea, or at least very few.
Is it still in draft form? Where is it right now in the pipeline?
So we submitted to the Legislative Service Bureau. We submitted our language. They take it and make sure that it's legal and written correctly, and then we submit it this week. So we believe we'll have it back this week and be available for co-sponsorship on the Senate floor.
Let's go a little bit deeper as to what actually happened. The Lansing State Journal stories have indicated that prior to this, the Listening Ear took the approach of accepting individuals for who they are now and not for who they have been in the past. That's why they haven't been previously performing background checks on volunteers. What do you make of that rationale?
Listen, I think it's a lovely idea, but I just don't think it's dealing with some of the harsh realities that we have out there. And especially when you have someone who has been sexually abused, who's been raped or assaulted, the idea that that person would have to go and deal with and speak to a person who had committed an act like the ones those three gentlemen have committed. I'm not trying to say, you know, they haven't become better people. What I'm saying is that I'm not worried as much about them as I'm worried about the victims of sexual assault. Those victims should not have to be re-victimized by dealing with someone who has been a sex offender in the past. It is too dangerous to assume that we know someone just by seeing them or by talking to them. Past actions do have some relationship to how someone will act in the future, and I don't think someone like that should be dealing with someone who's been assaulted. I don't think it's right, and I think a lot of assault victims would tell you that they feel re-victimized by having to deal with someone who was a sexual predator in the past.
We're talking with State Senator Curtis Hertel Jr. about legislation he's working on to prevent registered sex offenders from counseling sexual assault victims and children here in Michigan. Several groups that work with victims have cut ties, at least for now, with the listening ear, including MSU, the Firecracker Foundation, and the Small Talk Children's Assessment Center. Do you fear that victims of assault in the Lansing area could be underserved by the fallout from this?
Well, I think all those groups are going to have to pick up a little bit and do more. I know that the listening ear, just on this past week, finally agreed to eliminate those volunteers and to start doing background checks. That's a good first step in actually rebuilding a trust in this community. I think they did lose a lot of trust among not only advocates, but also people who have been sexually abused. So I'm hoping that they'll be able to rebuild that trust. But I think it's a serious problem when for 22 days, for 3 weeks, they knew about this and really didn't do much. And my feeling is they should be making an apology to the community, that they made a mistake and that this was a bad plan and that they won't do it again.
Any thoughts, any advice for victims right now while we wait on legislation?
Well, hopefully this problem's ended in Lansing, with what listening ear just did. So that's good. I hope they won't have to wait long for this legislation. We still have a few days in this session before we break for summer. It's not going to get done before that, but we certainly want to get it done before January. So I think we have places where people can go, but we still need the listening ear to work. It's just they have to rebuild that trust with the community. I hope they do.
State Senator Curtis Hertel Jr. of Meridian Township is our guest here on WKAR's Current State. Some other topics here. Yesterday on the program, we spoke with State Rep Tom Leonard about the Detroit Public Schools bailout plan that's gone to the Senate from the House. He spoke in favor and voted in favor of the House plan, saying that it includes proper reforms. What do you make of it?
I think they missed the mark. I think the Senate plan was a good plan. I think it helped build to a long-term stability for the school district. You know, the Detroit Public Schools are in a very bad situation. And sure, some of it is because of local decisions, but a lot of it's because of state decisions. If you look at the history, when we first took over the financial management of Detroit Public Schools in the late 90s, There were 140,000 kids in the system. They're now down to 40,000 kids for a system that was actually at one point at 300,000. So you can't run a school system with 40,000 kids. The emergency manager there has taken out short-term loans to try to keep the budget balanced. And now only $3,000 is getting back into the classroom. You have mold. You have rodents. You can't control the heat in the buildings. It's a terrible situation. But the only way to solve it is to long term rebuild the district. And I don't think that the House plan does that. And the biggest part they don't do is actually help to look at closing or at least preventing from opening more charter schools that are failing. I don't have a problem with some charter schools. There are some charter schools in Detroit that do a great job. But there are some of the worst charter schools in the state, also in the city of Detroit. And some of them are just making a profit off of kids. And we need to find a balance there. And I think the Senate plan did that. The House plan certainly does not. You know, my grandfather was a teacher in the Detroit Public Schools. But right now, the teachers that are teaching there really want to help these kids. There is no reason to teach in that district, considering all the problems it's having, unless you're really passionate about wanting to help those kids. And to punish them makes no sense. Maybe we should be punishing the emergency managers who are making, you know, triple, six-figure salaries, got a huge bailout when they left, and put us in this terrible situation. Those are the people we should be punishing, not the teachers. It doesn't make any sense.
Could a Detroit Education Commission still take shape here, or do you expect the measure to go that goes to the governor's desk not to include one?
Listen, I always have hope, but I tell you what I've seen in this process over and over again is the Senate comes up with a bipartisan plan, and the House Republicans derail that, send it back to the Senate, and the Senate caves. I've told some of my colleagues in the Senate that I think sometimes they have Stockholm syndrome. They continually send good legislation over to the House and get bad legislation back, and continue to do it over and over and over again.
Do you expect that this time?
I hope not, but I think that every indication so far is that the Senate will pass the House plan, and I think they'll do it on a straight partisan vote, and I think it'll be bad for the city of Detroit and bad for public schools around the state, because long term, when the district fails, it will affect every district in the state. We will be on the hook for those dollars. We have to save those schools, not only because it's the morally correct thing to do for the kids in Detroit, but it's the financially correct thing to do for the entire state, and this plan does not do that.
A pair of Senate energy bills that update the state's most recent energy legislation recently moved out of committee into the full Senate. These are Senate bills 437 and 438 from Mike Nofs. How do you feel about these pair of bills?
I think they need more work. I don't think they're terrible. I agree with parts of them. I think that we need to have just a little more work on the renewable side and on the energy efficiency side. And I think that so far my caucus has been holding strong on that. There's a big debate in the Republican caucus between the choice side and the regulated energy side. Mike Nofs on the regulated side. I agree with him on that. And what I will hope happen is that he will end up agreeing with us to include some more renewables in that discussion. I'm not going to vote for it in its current form. I'm hoping we can get some more renewables in there.
How long do you expect it to take?
Well, the Republican caucus was talking about it for 4 or 5 hours last week, and still having it's a long bill.
This is taking a long time, though.
It's going to take a long time. But you know, sometimes it takes government a long time to get something right, and I'd rather get a good product than have it happen quicker.
In the aftermath of Melissa Gilbert's withdrawal from the 8th District congressional race, what Democrats would you like to see consider a run?
Well, I think, you know,
you can include yourself in that if you want.
Well, I mean, people have talked to me, and, you know, I'm not saying no right now, but I will say that, you know, my first job and responsibility is as a father. My dad taught me that you could be a public servant and still be a good father. If someone's got to show me how serving in Congress and being a good father is possible. So it's just difficult. So I'm looking at those options. But right now, if you ask me today, the answer would be no, but I'm still listening. I think we have some great opportunity. Now, I think Sam Singh would be a great candidate. Barb Byram would be a great candidate. Gretchen Whitmer would obviously be a great candidate. Andy Shore, Tom Cochran, they would all be great. Nathan Triplett, I've heard his name bandied around. I think he'd be a good candidate.
How long do you think it'll take for everybody who wants a say in this to arrive at at least a short list?
Well, technically, legally, we can't do much now. We have to wait till after the primary is over, and then she has to apply for her medical reasoning for getting off the ballot, and then they make a choice. But practically speaking, if we want to win, we need a candidate within the next couple of weeks, because the reality is we need to raise the money to actually run a real campaign, and we got to get to the doors. It's a big district. You're talking about not only Ingham County, and I'm sure Democrats are going to do great in Ingham, but Livingston and Northern Oakland, and you really have to get out there on the doors, talking to people, to events, and running for Congress has to be your job for the next 3 months. So somebody's got to decide their willingness to do that.
State Senator Curtis Hertel Jr. of Meridian Township, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, in a couple of weeks, Great Lakes governors will decide whether to approve a diversion of Lake Michigan water to Waukesha, Wisconsin. That city's water is contaminated with radium. A Waukesha water official explains why the diversion's justified and responds to critics who fear a slippery slope leading to more diversions. That's on the way. An in-depth overview of Ken Burns' iconic Civil War series comes to WKAR-TV tomorrow night. WKAR World brings you the program Wednesday at 8 p.m. In anticipation of the broadcast, Current State takes you back to a 2013 MSU Museum tour with WKAR's Peter Wharf and MSU History Professor Roger Rosentrater. The two explored some of the many artifacts on display in the four-year-long exhibit, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. Professor Rosentrater led an exploration of soldiers' stories, uniforms, weapons, and personal effects.
Here's another artifact here, Harris Hillard's 3rd Cavalry decorative box. The reason I noticed it here is it talks about at the end of the war, because what happens, getting back to Michigan cavalrymen, is when the war is over, as was normally the case, you know, the Southerners go home to the destruction that's been left behind. Well, Northerners said, we won the war, we want to come home. And most of them did come home. There were some exceptions, though. One group of exceptions was the Michigan Cavalry Brigade, because they were sent west to deal with what was then perceived as an Indian problem, right? And we need veteran, skilled cavalrymen. So you can imagine these guys. They'd just gone through the Grand March in late May of 1865 in Washington, and they're going home, or so they think. And as they make that train trip, when they get to St. Louis, Missouri, and the train's not turning north, and no one's told them, by the way, you know, we're just getting on the train, boys. So they finally end up in the Dakota Territories, and they spent about the next 6 to 9 months out west, taking casualties and doing a part of what they were supposed to do, which was to protect settlers from the Indian threat, or the perceived Indian threat, as it were. Then to show you the gratitude the government had when they finally mustered them out, they said, all right, you guys can go home now. Good luck. And they didn't make provision for them to come home, so they ended up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and they had to fortunately the Michigan congressional delegation was able to find some money and bring them home. Otherwise, they'd probably still be there, or maybe they would have settled in Utah for all I know. But I thought it was a little bit unfair to say, you know, we're going to make you stay in. I mean, they were in the Army. They had to stay. I mean, they couldn't just go home. They certainly were not excited at all. They had joined up to fight the Confederates, not to fight the Sioux.
That's an amazing story that probably not many people know, that these were soldiers who thought the war was over. They were put on a train, assuming they were on their way home, and then they were taken out west to fight Indians.
Yeah. And again, it was quite a shock, I'm sure, to them to suddenly say, okay. And they were fairly disgruntled, as you might imagine. Matter of fact, there are a number of instances of guys deserting. I mean, as soon as a boat stopped somewhere, and they had already been told at this point, they immediately got, and they in some cases they were not allowed off the boat, you know, because they went up the Missouri River. That's where the boat comes into, and they said, well, we're not letting guys off, because in the previous stops, whenever we get off, people don't come back.
Yeah. So, Roger Rosentrater's history professor at Michigan State University. We're touring the exhibit today, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary at the Michigan State University Museum. Can we step over here to something that might be very familiar to people who are interested in the Civil War? It's one of the smallest items in the display and in any Civil War display, but probably has one of the greatest impacts throughout the war and throughout the history of war.
Right. Well, you're looking at a mini ball, and it was named after its French inventor, Claude Monet. Now, we can't say Monet as Americans, so we had to call it mini, but it is the .58 caliber cartridge that was used in your basic Civil War musket. And there is a cartridge, a paper cartridge below that, which shows you, and if you were to open that, there would be black powder in there as well as that particular bullet. So if you take the Springfield, which is up here on display, there is a ramrod, and what you have to do is go through a 9-step process to load this thing. And we can't do it on the radio, but nevertheless, you have to take the cartridge, you got to tear the cartridge, you got to put the powder in, you got to ram the powder, put the bullet in, ram the bullet in. Then you have to put the ramrod back because you're going to need it again, right? Then you have to put a cartridge, a percussion cap, as it were, near the base of the rifle, and then you're ready to fire. I mean, and it's, if you're really good, you are supposed to be able to do this 3 times a minute. It's pretty mind-boggling, I think, when I think about the process involved.
I can't imagine doing that fast while on a battlefield with guys shooting at me.
No, and that's a very good point. You know, people are shooting at you, and there's a very interesting scene in the movie Glory, which some of the listeners would have certainly have seen, where one of the young recruits is firing away, and suddenly the officer, Matthew Broderick, comes up and...
Attention, company!
As you were. You're a good shot, Private.
Thank you, sir. Squirrel hunting.
You ever killed a man?
No, sir.
But you're handy with a gun.
Yes, sir.
Reload. Faster! Faster! Discharge your weapon. Do it! Now do it again, only this time, I want it done quickly. Faster! Reload! Faster!
And he's firing the pistol in his ear because he's saying, hey, this is the distraction you have to deal with.
And he's saying faster and faster while shooting in the soldier's ear.
You know, as opposed to, oh, yeah, I'm just kind of shooting bottles or whatever. Now, the range of this particular bullet, because it's rifled, the barrel of the rifle is got grooves in it. And that allows this bullet to travel accurately about 400 to 500 yards. Why that's important is that the tactics haven't kept up with the weaponry. And if you can start, as I explained to my students, if you can start hitting people at 3 or 4 football fields and you're marching, not necessarily running, even if you're loading slowly, you can do a pretty good job and a lot of damage.
The tactics were based on older methods that weren't taking into account a more accurate weapon.
Well, a smoothbore musket has a range of maybe 100 yards. So think one football field. So if I can still, and it still gets loaded somewhat similarly, so if I can load it once, crossing 100 yards, or again, as I tell my students, how quickly can you run that 100-yard dash? Now, they didn't run a lot in the Civil War. They marched because having that massed firepower was very important. But you can still cover 100 yards fairly quickly. And again, if you've got bayonets and there's a lot of you, you're going to intimidate the guy at the other end, even if he's got the first shot off. But at 4 or 5 football fields, that's a whole different process.
He's still far away.
He is. And again, that's a long distance to try to travel, and you can get several rounds off. And again, if the idea is massing, I mean, bringing together literally hundreds, if not thousands, of rifles at one time, and then firing fairly routinely, again, covering that terrain is almost impossible. If you think about the Battle of Fredericksburg, for example, the Yankees covered about a 500 to 600-yard open field. The Confederates were at the top behind a stone wall. There were several thousands of them at that stone wall so that someone could load and hand a weapon so they didn't have to even load themselves if they were in the front rank. But the point being is that after 14 continuous charges, the Yankees never got any closer than 40 yards.
Roger Rosentrater is history professor at Michigan State University. We've been looking at the exhibit, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. Professor Rosentrater, thanks very much.
All right, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.
Coming up on Current State, we'll find out why the greatest enemy to William Shakespeare may be poison ivy, as the company of Shakespeare in the Arb gets ready to perform at the Mathai Botanical Gardens and Nichols Arboretum in Ann Arbor. That and more after the break on Current State. Indeed, if your budget allows, I would hope that you follow up on Brad Walker's request there and consider a donation to WKAR. It makes a difference in our program, Current State. All things considered, Morning Edition have huge price tags on them. please go to WKAR.org, click on that Give Now link. We do greatly appreciate it. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State here on WKAR. In 2 weeks, a final decision will come on the Waukesha water diversion request. The governors of the 8 U.S. states bordering the Great Lakes, including Michigan's Rick Snyder, of course, will vote on the Wisconsin City's request to divert Lake Michigan water for its use because of radium in its local water supply. As a city straddling the Great Lakes Basin, Waukesha's request is allowed under the provisions of the Great Lakes Compact. Last month, the 10-member Great Lakes Compact Council, which includes representatives from two Canadian provinces, recommended approval of the request. However, many environmentalists oppose the approval, fearing it will set a precedent that will lead to more diversion requests. Today we're going to hear from a supporter of Waukesha's request. Dan Dukniak is an employee of the city of Waukesha, serving as the general manager of its water utility. Dan Dukniak, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Mark. How are you this morning?
I am well, thank you. First, I'd like to get your response to last month's vote here by the Great Lakes Compact Council. It was unanimous in favor of your city's request with one abstention, I'll point out. What do you think that, what do you take from that? What does that mean?
Well, we were pleased with the decision. Obviously, Waukesha has been working on this for a long time. I've been at Waukesha. I'm in my 14th year there, and I've been working on this for that entire time. And it was very encouraging that the regional body passed the findings of fact unanimously. However, we need to make sure that we understand that the final decision has not yet been made, and that will happen, as you said, on June 21st, but we are encouraged by the findings of fact of the regional body.
Were you expecting that favorable a margin supporting the diversion?
Well, we were hopeful that, and we're very thankful to the members of the regional body and compact council that they did operate based on the compact and in good faith and followed the rules and the laws that were put in place for the compact and came to the conclusions that they came to. And we believed, because of the application was put together, obviously, by us and reviewed over a five-year period by the state of Wisconsin and then finally forwarded to the regional body, that we were in a position where we were hopeful that we would have a unanimous support on the findings of fact.
It now goes to just the governors of the 8 U.S. states for the final decision. Does the unanimous vote last month make you more encouraged about the final vote here in 2 weeks?
Well, we're hopeful that it'll end up and Waukesha will finally be able to resolve its public health issue that we have been facing for a number of years. We're hopeful that that will be the case, but there's still a lot of work to be done. We're still answering questions that are being asked, and we'll see how we move forward here on June 21st. We're hopeful, though.
I've got to ask you about the Compact Implementation Coalition. This is a coalition of environmental groups that cites statistics claiming a whopping percentage of the public is against your city's diversion request. They say that on their website, 38,000 messages sent to Great Lakes governors and Canadian premiers oppose the application, and that among more than 11,000 what they call unique comments, 98% were opposed. That would suggest the public strongly disagrees with approval. What do you take from that?
Well, you know, it's understandable that if the public is told and people are told something will harm the Great Lakes, even if it's not factual, the response will be to oppose that proposal. And critics of our project engaged in an extensive media and social media campaign of misleading and inaccurate statements that were intended to raise, you know, false fears about the impacts of our proposal. The fact is that under the proposal, we will borrow 1/1,000,000th of 1% of the Great Lakes water and then return 100% of that volume to the Great Lakes with zero impact on the lake levels. The compact prohibits water from going beyond counties that straddle the Great Lakes Basin Divide like Waukesha is. So we are no precedent for water to go to California or other distant places. We're currently using groundwater that is depleted and contaminated with a naturally occurring carcinogen, radium, and that is connected to the Great Lakes Basin. So the precedent we set is only for communities that may have similar circumstances, and only if they are in counties that straddle the Great Lakes Basin. And I think the purpose of the compact is to ensure that decisions are made on science and not on politics or emotions. And I think the state of Michigan, which held hearings on Waukesha's application, explained the basis of the compact decisions at the start of its hearing process. And it was important because it said that states, and this is quoting, by law, are not allowed to base our recommendation on whether or not there is widespread support or opposition to the proposed application. Our review of Waukesha diversion application must adhere to the specific Great Lakes Compact criteria. Therefore, it is not simply a matter of public opinion, nor a vote tally for or against the application. So I think what they're saying there is that they have to go by the criteria that is set up in the Great Lakes Compact, which is very important if we want the compact to succeed in protecting the great resource that we have here in the Great Lakes, and that the decisions on the proposal must be based on science and facts and not based on emotions or politics.
Our guest is Dan Dukniak, the general manager of Waukesha, Wisconsin's water utility. He is a supporter of a plan to divert Lake Michigan water to Waukesha to help address the city's water, which is contaminated with radium. We'll also make clear your city has been ordered to find a new water source. This is an obligation. It's not volitional. But I would like to get your responses to what some environmental groups say are flaws in the proposal. Let's break this down a little bit more specifically. You alluded to this before, but maybe the most common is the fear of a slippery slope that would lead to other requests, possibly from areas much farther from the Great Lakes. Go a little deeper with us and tell us why people shouldn't be concerned about that.
Again, that goes into the false statements that are being made, because it will not lead for water going to further places, because Waukesha is a legal diversion. It is not precedent for any illegal diversion. The compact also requires water to be recycled back to the lake after use and treatment, and the drafters of the compact ensured that the lakes will be protected against any withdrawals that could harm the Great Lakes. So Waukesha's precedent is very narrow. The regional body concluded and said that there are unique circumstances associated with our application, and those include the court order that we have to comply with the radium standard, that we have a confined aquifer that limits the recharge of that aquifer, so that's why we have the drawdown in that aquifer. We have unavoidable significant environmental impacts of alternatives. We were, like I alluded to before, we will return approximately 100% of the water to Lake Michigan, and we'll have a high quality of Waukesha return flow due to our wastewater treatment plant. But I think the most important one and the most unique one is that current interconnection with the Great Lakes Basin watershed and the loss of water from it. Currently, we are diverting approximately a third of our water, 30% of our water comes from the Lake Michigan watershed. So we are currently diverting approximately 1.6 million gallons a day to the Mississippi River Basin and not returning it back to the Lake Michigan Basin. This proposal will eliminate that practice and will return that water back to the Great Lakes watershed. So I think, like I said, the uniqueness of our application will set a very narrow precedent, and the diversion that we are applying for is legal under the compact. It is not a precedent for any illegal diversion.
Let me bring up another point. There have also been studies by the U.S. Geological Survey showing that Waukesha's aquifer is not in decline, that it's actually recharging. And critics of the diversion have alluded to this. What do you make of that study?
Well, the overall trend is still a decline. It's still a downward decline. A short-term rise at the time of a recession or abandonment of some of the deep aquifer wells due to some communities switching from groundwater to Lake Michigan water does not indicate that levels will continue to rise. In fact, we have seen the same thing happen in northeastern Illinois and up in the Green Bay area in Wisconsin here. And we've seen that rebound only to return to that overall decline. The fact of the matter is the aquifer has limited recharge due to a layer of shale or a thick layer of rock that prevents water from naturally percolating through the soils and getting to the deep aquifer and recharging it. The regional body found that withdrawals exceed the recharge rate and that it was unsustainable for Waukesha. And you have to remember, Waukesha is the largest user in this region. In addition, continued use of local groundwater or shallow groundwater would cause unreasonable environmental impacts. They have also shown that the withdrawal rate is between 5 to 10 times the recharge rate, which again indicates and which led the regional body to conclude that this was not a sustainable water supply for the long term for the city of Waukesha.
There were two parts of Waukesha's original request that have not survived here, though. One was a request to include two service areas in your diversion request. That was denied. Put that in context for us. What does that mean? What do you make of that denial?
Well, again, we go back when we were drawing up the application with regards to the service area and with regards to where the long-term planning for this proposal. Remember, we're installing infrastructure that's going to cost around $200 million. And when we're installing that, we want to make sure that we're planning not out for 5, 10, 20 years. We're planning out for 100 years. So our state law required us to look at our service area and what our service area was going to do. So we were mandated by state law to develop a service area and to provide for water for that service area, which is how our application was developed. Ultimately, when it got to the regional body, that some of those areas were removed from the service area, ultimately leading to the city of Waukesha going or only being allowed for that application or allowed for the proposal as it moved forward. And we are fine with that. Our first and goal, first and foremost, our goal is for the residents of the city of Waukesha. We need a new water supply. We've been facing a water issue, a health issue in our city for a number of years, and we need to resolve this issue for our residents.
Very good.
And so it's important that we can move that forward.
We want to thank our guest. Dan Dukniak is the general manager of the Waukesha, Wisconsin Water Utility and a supporter of the plan to divert Lake Michigan water to Waukesha to help that city's water, which has been contaminated by radium. A final decision on the water diversion request will come 2 weeks from today. Governors of the 8 U.S. states bordering the Great Lakes will vote on that request. Dan Dukniak, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day.
This environmental segment of Current State is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news on the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. Public performances of works by the bard William Shakespeare are not a new thing. Shakespeare in the Park is traditionally done on a stage or a pavilion of some kind, but Current State's Jamie Paisley explored something a bit different happening in Ann Arbor for the next few weekends. Welcome, Jamie.
Thanks, Mark. And you're right, this one is, you know, a bit different. It's called Shakespeare in the Arb, as in Shakespeare in the Arboretum. These performances of Shakespeare's Love's Labor's Lost take place in the Nichols Arboretum on the east side of the University of Michigan campus in Ann Arbor. However, again, rather than a stage, the play actually happens on the grounds of the Arboretum itself. As scene changes occur, the company, as well as the audience itself, moves around the Arboretum to the next designated locale. To learn more, I spoke with the founder and artistic director of Shakespeare in the Arb, Kate Mendeloff, about how this partnership began.
Well, actually, they approached me. At that point, Mathai Botanical Gardens and Nichols Arboretum were separate institutions, or I guess we'd call them public goods on the campus. Nichols Arboretum was by far the smaller organization, and it had a membership program, but not a very big one. It just would be Nichols Arboretum, applied for a grant from the Ford Foundation for arts funding for 3 years and received the grant. And so they were planning to do a theater production, a dance performance, and a music performance. I was approached by the development person at Nichols Arboretum, a woman named Inger Schultz, who had seen several of my theater productions at the Residential College, and knew that I had just directed an outdoor production of Chekhov's The Seagull in the East Quad courtyard. And it moved around the courtyard and then moved downstairs into a room in the building. But the environmental theater idea was definitely, underneath the staging of that. And she contacted me and asked if I would like to direct something at Nichols Arboretum. Initially, I thought I would do Chekhov again, but realized that I needed to do something that would project to more people. Chekhov's very nuanced, and it would be harder to do it outside. It's very text-based and subtle. So I decided that Shakespeare would be a better choice, and that the best Shakespeare play for showing how we are transformed by our journey into nature would be Midsummer Night's Dream.
Exactly.
And I was a little worried about it because it seemed a little cliched to do, but I went ahead with it, and it was so successful that we did it again the following year, and then it's become an institution.
Shakespeare in the Arb takes place throughout the grounds of the Nichols Arboretum for the next 3 weekends. And according to founder Kate Mendeloff, there is an underlying mentality when it comes to how to handle the props, the staging, and even the audience of this Shakespearean troupe amongst the Nichols Arboretum grounds.
The Arboretum is a museum. I mean, it really was designed by an important landscape architect named Jens Jensen, to be an exhibit of the natural plantings appropriate to this part of Michigan. The Woodland Glen, which is the area where Titania and Oberon meet, and where I've staged many moments like Hero's funeral, fake funeral, in Much Ado About Nothing. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous area, and it's all native plants. The area that we're using a lot in our current production is called the Magnolia Valley, and there are many different varieties of magnolia trees in that area, and it's very, very beautiful. There are some delightful things about it. There's a tree that lets off a light blossom. Sometimes that floats by, and that's just beautiful. We try to incorporate references to nature. I mean, Shakespeare's language is full of nature. He grew up in a rural environment, and that's one particularly delightful thing about Shakespeare in the Arb is when we're talking about nature, we're in it. And hearing that language when you're feeling the breeze and looking around at a beautiful setting just tightens it. It certainly does for me, and I hope it does for the audience. And that's one reason why I get very sad if a tree gets cut down in the Arb. Actually, with Love's Labor's Lost, there was a wonderful tree where one of the key scenes in the play happened, and it died. And they kept it up because a family of raccoons was living in it. And so I sent an email, I think, early in January, Woodsman Spare This Tree, and said, please leave what's left of the tree up for Shakespeare in the Arb. But when the snows melted and we started to trek around and look and see what was there, it's really in bad shape. So we had to compromise on another situation. But still, you know, that tree has significance for me.
Now, there is the question of what happens when weather is not really on your side to those
right.
performances.
Well, we certainly have had our share of struggling with the weather. Ironically, the only production where we had absolutely no rainouts was The Tempest, where it's supposed to be storming the entire time. So we had to create the storm with a thunder sheet, you know, one of those aluminum sheets that sounds like thunder. That was funny. But it really, you never know. You never know. Ultimately, we call the play off if we are going to be hit by a major electrical storm.
Mm-hmm.
We can't allow people to be in the woods if there's going to be lightning. And so, I've spent my share of evenings pinned to a radar machine trying to predict when storms are going to hit. And I guess I'm trying to think, 16 years ago, maybe radar wasn't so easy to get. But that's the piece I can't control.
Yeah.
And so that can be very frustrating.
And I suppose, of all the plays, Love's Labor's Lost might be the best opportunity for a picnic, since it contains, I think, the longest scene, the masked Russians, I think that's the...
Oh, right. Except in our case, they're Spaniards.
Okay.
Because the masked Russians were an in-joke in the Elizabethan court. And since we don't have Queen Elizabeth with us to laugh at that joke, I have interpreted them as Spaniards, and that's because one of the main comic characters in Love's Labor's Lost is Don Adriano de Amargo, and he is a Spanish knight. But yes, it is an incredibly long scene, though I have cut it considerably. Shakespeare, it's interesting. It was an early Shakespeare play. It is as early, they think, he wrote it right after Comedy of Errors, so that's right at the beginning of his career. I think it's a pretty sophisticated play in terms of the writing, but one of the things he didn't quite get down is how to break up acts and scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only really one scene in each act, but it's often incredibly long. You're right. You could eat a picnic in any one of the scenes. And you're encouraged to, you know, bring food, although you're discouraged from noisy chip bags and things like that.
Mm.
And it's best to have your picnic before and then be able to enjoy the play.
And needless to say, make sure you clean up after yourself as well.
Right. That's it. There are no garbage cans down there.
Right.
And so you do. You have to be careful.
We've been speaking with Kate Mendeloff, the Artistic Director of Shakespeare in the Arb. And if people wanted to find out more information about Shakespeare in the Arb and the 3 weekends that your production of Love's Labor's Lost is going to be occurring, where can they find that information?
They should get to the Mathai Botanical Gardens Nichols Arboretum website. And they could Google Shakespeare in the Arb, and that will take them there.
Kate, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our program for today. That music sounds great. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, MSU flute professor and Lansing Symphony principal Richard Sherman talks with us about his recent CD for Lansing's Blue Griffin Recordings. WKAR's Peter Worf speaks with Richard about his Golden Instruments French Connection. Also, Helping Hands Respite Care's mission is to improve the quality of life for families caring for children and adults with disabilities, chronic illness, or age-related conditions. For our Neighbors in Action segment, we'll speak with a volunteer from the organization and Helping Hands Executive Director. That's all tomorrow. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is informative, insightful, indispensable. It's all about what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Politics, education, stories from around the state in your hometown. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get good podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope you can join us Wednesday. It's Current State on WKAR.